Okay, well, we'll start then, if you're ready.
Okay.
I'm very happy to be talking to Conor Walton, an Irish artist. He's had numerous solo exhibitions. He's been an artist for pretty much lots of exhibitions. Had some of his work as a postage stamp. He's been on the Sky Arts Portrait Artist of the Year, and he currently has an exhibition in Paris of his drawings. So, hello, Conor. How are you?
Hi. Good, I'm great.
That's good. Well, we'll just dive in with a nice, easy question. Why do you think art exists, Conor?
Why do I think art exists? Well, I'm not sure it does exist. I'm one of these people who had a real problem going through art college and ever since with the whole idea of art and what it was supposed to be and the whole question of, you know, but is it art and all of those sort of things. And I, you know, I don't call myself an artist. I think of myself as a painter. And what I've come back to after all, you know, reading lots of books on the subject of art, and you know, I've got a little bookshelf with books with art in the title, and some of them are, you know, is it art, or the story of art, or art and meaning, or art and, you know, whatever it is, and the purpose of art and all of this sort of thing. And they all strike me as, for the most part, hugely pretentious and selling something very unconvincingly. So I don't really go for the what I think of as the modern concept of art, which has existed for, you know, roughly the last 300 years. To my mind, art is basically fabrication. It's making things. It's anything that involves skill, that involves technique, which is a very old definition of art. It's sort of, you know, 2,000-3,000 years old or more. And basically the opposite of art is nature. Nature is self-generating. It doesn't require intelligence. It doesn't require skill. It doesn't require consciousness. It just grows. And art is anything that doesn't grow, that requires, you know, skill, technique, cunning, intelligence, learning, foresight, all of those sort of things. So my, you know, the modern notion of art isn't really set against nature. It's set against mass production. It's set against kitsch. It's set against lots of other things.
When you say set against now, what do you mean?
It opposes, you know, what isn't art, you know. I know people who don't consider what I do art, you know. Like when I was going through art college, people said, oh, that's not art, that's illustration, or that's not art, that's kitsch. You know, some people think today that painting can't really be art because art has moved on, you know, art has progressed onto a new plane, and art is a concept. Art is a, you know, art must be new and challenging and original. And you can't really do anything in painting these days that's new or challenging or original. Therefore, painting can't be art. So I leave that, you know, if that's what people think, that's fine. And I'm not really bothered whether people think of me as an artist in that way. What I do is very old-fashioned, really, and I'm happy to do it. And, you know, what I do is, you know, to me it belongs with, you know, basket weaving and growing your own potatoes and things like that, which don't make an awful lot of economic sense these days, you know, like people who knit their own woolen sweaters and stuff like that. You know, if you, given the price of labor and the, you know, the realities of modern economy, it just doesn't make any sense to do that. Some people still do it. So I think of myself as sort of belonging in that, you know, among that crew of people cleaving to an outdated technology.
Right, for a couple of things there. So you're saying art is the opposite of nature.
In the old, there used to be three sort of fundamental concepts that were set: art, nature, and science.
Right.
And they sort of opposed and complemented one another. And those have sort of gone out of sync a little bit for us, partly because the nature of modern science has changed and the nature of art had to change with it. And nature itself is a concept that's sort of been under attack for the last 200-300 years, with the scientific revolution. You know, there's a notion that nature is sort of conquered, basically, and it's no longer interesting because it's conquered. That I think is part of the idea behind modernism, the turn away from representational art, that all of a sudden it just wasn't interesting to copy or honor or do homage to nature, because nature had become a slave of science. And it was no longer conceived of as creation in the old sense, as something that was to be worshipped.
So do you still draw a distinction then between art and science? You were saying there's three principles: art, science, and nature. Do you still, because in the beginning you were saying everything that's not doesn't happen naturally.
The old distinction between art and science, or an art and a science, the science was basically the theory, the supposed knowledge behind it, and the art was the practical engagement of it, so if you're a surgeon, for example, there's the art of surgery, which is the actual practical engagement with it of saving lives, and then there's the science of it, which is the theory of medicine that you're putting into practice, the ideas that the reason that this cure works is because X, the reason why if you take this bit out, the person will get better is X. That's the science, but you've got the practice, which is the art. And, the same way with music, you've got the science, which is, harmony. And then you've got the art, which is playing the instrument. So it's not art and science in the modern sense. Art and science, we've sort of divided into artists and scientists, and that, there are different, they're like different fields of knowledge. To me, the concept of art has to be universal. It has to apply to all aspects of human endeavor. And the concept of science has to apply to all aspects of human endeavor. When I paint, I'm using science. There's chemistry, there's the understanding of the materials and how they go together. There's optics, there's, all of these things are science. So I don't see an absolute distinction. Obviously, what I'm doing is it's not high technology. It's not obscure or cutting edge science the way that, someone manufacturing a microchip has to, exploit techniques and mathematics and all the rest that are, way beyond my mind. But I'd still say that what I do is, scientific in its own way.
Right. And do you draw any distinction between art and craft, or does it all under that same kind of umbrella of art?
No, I don't really. I think there's art that's more ambitious than other types of work. There's the simple basket weaver who's the typical sort of handicraft.
Yeah.
And today, who there's no great need to think very deeply about what the basket weaver does. And the pattern, you know, you can follow a regular pattern. You can invent a new pattern for a slightly different type of basket. But it's not like you're not deploying huge levels of humanistic thought. I think in terms of the different arts and their application, you've got the arts of imagination. You know, you've got arts that engage the human imagination in its higher flights and tell interesting stories and can go further places, but. To me, you know, craftsmanship is sort of fundamental. You know that I think that the brain works best when it's coordinated with the rest of the body. You know, when it's doing something, you know, where there's eye hand coordination, where there's a sense of working with something physical,
yeah.
And you get that you get a certainty. You know.
Yeah.
You know, Albrecht Dürer said that, you know, when the mind works in conjunction with the hand, you get a sort of a certainty, because what you're doing is very directly under your control. It's more certain in some ways than, you know, science in its abstract theoretical sense. Science in, you know, the abstract theories are always in a state of revolution, and, you know, the theory is in that's in, you know, one decade will be thrown out the following. So science is always in a state of turmoil and revision. But when a single individual is working with a material straight under their, you know, under their hands, there's a sort of certainty there, you know, that doesn't really change. It's always very concrete, you know, it's always very specific to the experiences of the individual, what they're seeing, what they're perceiving, what they can control, what they can do with it. So it's grounded in some ways far more than something like theoretical physics, which, you know, falsifies itself as it progresses.
It falsifies itself.
Well, in the sense that, you know, Newton's physics, which was taken as, you know, absolute certainty, was basically falsified by Einstein. You know, Einstein came along and basically said, well, actually, you know, Newton's theory is all very well, but the whole abstract scheme is wrong. The calculations work up to a point, but they don't work beyond that point. And now we can see why. It's because the whole abstract scheme that Newton had of absolute space and absolute time was wrong.
Yeah.
So we have to, you know, ditch that. We can still use the Newtonian formulae for sort of shorthand calculations, but the whole structure is actually false. We now know it's false, and we can now see, you know, we can see that, you know, where Newton thought the gravity was, you know, a force acting at a distance, and people said, well, how can you have a force acting at a distance through a vacuum? You know, there's nothing. What's connecting the Earth to the Moon? There's nothing. You're saying there's nothing there. It's a vacuum. So how does this force operate through the vacuum? How is it transmitted? And Newton basically said, you know, he said, you know, hypotheses non fingo. I don't make hypotheses. Basically, he said, well, it works. You know, I don't know how it works, but it works. My calculations work, and I don't have to think about this problem. It bugged a lot of people because it looked like magic. And a lot of Newton's critics, you know, tried to analyze the concepts and basically said these concepts don't make any sense. You know, people like Berkeley and Hume and Bale, they said it doesn't make any sense. But it wasn't until you know, Einstein came along, that they were actually vindicated. And Einstein said, yes, they don't make any sense. And, you know, you don't need this notion of a force acting at a distance. You can treat gravity as a distortion of space-time. It doesn't need to be a force. It's everything comes down to local conditions rather than action at a distance. So the total conceptual framework in science can change. And science can be very dogmatic that way, that you need this big abstract structure in order to coordinate everything and justify the mathematics. But when you've got a craftsman building something, you know, he just knows it works and it will always work. And I don't think, you know, the advances of technology or advances in conceptual thought don't necessarily change the quality of the achievement. They don't affect the achievement, you know. Yeah. Like the Gothic, you know, the Gothic architect building his cathedral, if you look at his cathedral and think, oh God, you know, if only he'd had reinforced concrete and plate glass, God, what could he have done? That's bullshit. You know, he was doing fine. You know, he was doing brilliantly, in fact. And maybe he was doing even better because he didn't have, reinforced concrete. Right. Because the materials, the structure, he's so wedded to the actual, to what you can do in stone, you know. The limitation of the material is his foundation, you know. And he'll explore everything that you can do in stone. And that is, in some ways, I think it's more interesting to work within those sort of limits than when technology makes almost everything possible. You know, that's why I think painting is still interesting and more interesting than, you know, painting on an iPad or something like that.
Well,
that goes back
to my original question, which if you take craft as being, you know, somewhat functional, the basket weaver is making a basket for a reason, or the potter is making a pot. When I said, why do you think art exists? I was really talking about paintings and why is it sustained? Like, why do we still, why are there still people like you painting? And there's a lot, in fact, I think there's probably more people who are engaged in making images like that or painting. And there seems to be a bit of a resurgence in realist kind of figurative kind of painting. But just as a kind of a general thing, why do you think art exists in the first place when it doesn't have the same kind of practical dimension to it that, say, a pot or a basket or something like that?
Well, you know, I earn a living from what I do. I sell my pictures, and I think they are functional in many ways. You know, there's a notion that art is useless, and I don't really believe that. I think it's very useful in different ways. You know, the fact is that art is useful socially, and you see it, you know, in the prices of art and the way it's commodified, that it is a marker of social prestige, and that I think has to be acknowledged straight out. That today, you know, people who buy art are generally rich people, and you know, I've lost track. You know, it's a long, long time since I heard of a painting making headlines for anything other than the price that it made, either at auction or, you know, the way you get these headlines of, you know, Estee Lauder Air gives 2 billion worth of Cubist paintings to the Metropolitan Museum or something like that.
Yeah.
2 billion?
Yeah.
You know, where do they get these figures from? But the fact is that, you know, in an age of mass production, the unique original work of art assumes an incredible value, a ridiculous value. And I'm hardly in the, you know, I'm in the great, you know, hierarchy and pyramid of the art world. I'm not quite a bottom feeder, but I'm not very high up. But it is useful. People use it. They use it to show how rich they are. They use it to show what good taste they have and whether their taste is cutting edge or traditional or all of these sort of things. So people show it to display their culture. And that's how it actually functions. That's how, to some extent, I managed to earn a living from.
But you didn't get into it for the money, surely.
No, I didn't. I got into it because I like making pictures. And
where does that come from? That's kind of what I was asking.
I suppose I didn't know where I was going when I started off. I didn't have a clue about contemporary art or anything. I liked drawing and making images, and I think, you know, some people are naturally visual people. I think that, you know, most people in the world are primarily verbal. They understand the world through words and through narrative. And they, you know, they to some extent believe what they hear. And I've never really been very good at that. I don't believe the truth of words for the most part. But I believe my eyes. I believe what I see. And I tend to understand the world through images. And making images for me is part of the process of trying to understand it,
of trying to make
sense of things. And that, I suppose, has been my own logic all along for making images, that by making images of things, you understand them, you grow to understand them, or partially at least.
Well, I certainly think that comes across in your work, and certainly as I receive what when I look at any of your paintings, there's that quality of figuring something out.
Yeah, I think at a certain point, you know, when I was a kid, I thought, well, I could be a comic strip artist. You know, I read comics 2000 AD and stuff like that, and I thought, well, maybe I could do that for a living. And my parents were a little bit worried about my, you know, career direction and what way I'd go, and they thought, well, maybe I could, you know, do architecture or something like that, which was struck them as reasonably visual but a profession, you know,
something to fall back on.
Yeah, well, something that they thought I could earn a living from, basically.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, I remember thinking about doing painting, basically thinking, well, painting, it holds the most potential, and basically because nobody be telling me what to do. It comes from me doing what I want, basically finding things, you know, discovery and freedom. So I thought painting is probably the freest avenue to be a visual person, by, you know, making images and basically seeing if I can sell them to people. Yeah. So and not, you know, not working to commission, not working with that sort of structure of making images to order, where, you know, which is what an illustrator or if you'd go into advertising or any of those sort of areas where you end up doing that.
Did you ever do any comics?
No, I didn't.
You didn't.
I did my own sort of mock-ups when I was a kid, you know, copying stuff. Yeah. And doing my own comics. But I never did it commercially or made money out of it.
Okay.
So, I still admire those who do it, you know. And it takes huge skill and, you know, the pressures, the productivity and the way you have to develop a style. You know, I think a lot of that work is really under appreciated and scoffed at, you know, looked down upon as illustration in the, you know, the official art world.
Oh, yeah. But I think like a lot of things in the world now, there's everything has its own little niche of people who are just totally into it, and within their own, within the whole comic world, there's superstars.
Yeah.
So you went to art college, and you had all the, you went in at, you were sort of a man out of your time by the sounds of it, in that you went in with these kind of old masters kind of appreciation, and you were right into the, Anna, we don't do that anymore, Connor.
I wanted to learn how to paint. You know, I went to art college expecting to learn, to be taught skills. Yeah. And that was, you know, the revolution had happened in Ireland, in, you know, in NCAD and places like that in 1968, basically, where the old school, the academics, got defeated, basically. There were still a few of them around when I went through. But
had all the plaster casts been got rid of by the time you got there?
There'd been a bit of a purge. A lot of those were thrown out of third and fourth floor windows. But there were a few left, but nobody drew them or anything like that. I studied in Florence subsequently, and it was such a shock the first time I went into this atelier in Florence, because they had all these plaster casts up and people drawing them, and it was like I was being, you know. I was in with the Antichrist, you know. I was being confronted by everything that I had been told was totally evil, basically.
So why did you choose that particular school in Florence? Because there's three, wasn't there? Were the three of them in existence at the time, the Angel and the Daniel Graves one? Because you went with them.
Angel Cecil, wasn't there.
Angel wasn't there.
Angel wasn't there. Dan Graves was there. There was awful bad blood between them. And
the three of them, or
between the two of them, really, because Dan Graves used to be Charles Cecil's assistant, basically, and he split from Charles, and really, you know, Charles had a Dan basically went off with most of Charles's students, and
that never goes down well.
Charles was deeply wounded, and I think he struggled just to get back on his feet after that. But you know, they were very different characters. I never actually didn't spend a lot of time with the Dan Graves crowd because there was such bad blood between them, and I regret that in some ways. I feel in hindsight that I should have crossed the line, but it was really. It was really an accident in that I had a personal introduction to Charles Cecil through one of my tutors in art college, and right. He said, go and meet this guy. And our first meeting ended in a blazing row. I felt quite bad because Charles had bought me lunch, but he basically looked at the work that I'd done at that point. I was just out of art college, and he basically said, you know, we might be able to save you. You know, you're a borderline case. You've been obviously corrupted by photography and modernism and lots of things, but we might be able to save you if we try hard. And I objected to this strongly. I said, well, you know, I'm not here to be saved. If I come here, it's, I want to learn what I want to learn. You know, I'm not looking for salvation. I want to be taught skills, and I didn't want to do what he did, which
that,
I felt
was that
was,
down to his personality or the way that kind of atelier teaching approach, do you think?
A lot of them are a little bit cultish. Charles is someone who is very vehement in his opinions. And, you know, he'll say, I hate modern art, and, you know, wish the camera was never invented, and all of these sort of things.
Nice
and
moderate,
say,
you know, opinions, yeah. Okay.
Yes, yeah, very, very moderate. And I respect his opinions, but the problem with a lot of these small ateliers is that they're very personality driven. And you get sort of, you know, the master and his pupils, and they tend to be very deferential. And people who have contrary opinions tend not to stick around very long.
Right.
So I didn't really stick around very long, but I learned things. I found it an interesting experience.
Would you recommend them? Like, if you're, say, I'm 18 now and I'm thinking of going to art college, do you think art college is worth going to nowadays, or is it still as bad as it was when you went to it? Say, I'm into this sort of art that you make, just kind of, I was thinking about it. The kind of art that you make, you never ask yourself the question, now, is that the right way up, or did they hang that upside down? It's very clear. That's a person. This is a pair. That's a, that kind of art. Because I think when people think of art now, they're like, now, which kind of an artist are you? You know, are you one of those weird new artists, or are you like an old fashioned artist? Say I'm this young person. I want to paint figuratively. I want to paint, that kind of thing. Is art college worth going to, do you think?
I don't know. I find it very difficult. Like when I went through art college, I think I was quite lucky in that, going through in the late 80s and early 90s, there were still teachers of an older generation who had been taught, they had a solid basis of skill behind them in what they did. They'd been taught skills and they could impart skills, although the whole teaching structure didn't really lend itself to the learning of skills, because all the projects, all the projects had to turn over in, 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah. And that it's just not long enough. You need to give it a chance for people to develop and to work on a much longer level to mature themselves. Yeah. When I went through, I'm sort of the opinion that that there's a saying of Nietzsche that if you don't want to go thirsty among men, you need to learn to drink out of all cups, and if you want to stay clean among men, you need to learn how to wash even with dirty water, and that sort of sums up my view of almost all the available art education. You have to go to more than one place to pick things up. Right. My problem with art college, I think art college is very challenging intellectually, but the skill base you just don't get. Yeah. And it's combining those two and combining them at a sufficiently young age that you get immersion. So I think there is interesting work coming out of the ateliers, more interesting work now than there was when I went through. I think some of the ateliers have matured, and there are there are great painters like Adam Miller coming through, people that I really admire. But I think you need to go to 2 or 3 places, perhaps very different places, to pick up different things. I still think there's some point to going to art college just to engage with the whole idea of modern art. I think some of the ateliers can be a little bit sort of on the reservation, with the little tribes who are at war with the world and fighting a losing battle. And, I don't like the idea of the reservation. I like the idea of, going out, if you're going to make war on the world, you better bring your weapons to bear on the big cities. You need to think like Al Qaeda and go and bomb the World Trade Center. There's no point sticking off in the backwaters. You need to embrace asymmetrical warfare.
I don't know if you're familiar with the article that was doing the rounds there a while ago by Noah Bradley, which was basically saying don't go to art college. I think that specifically relates to America, when the cost of art college is very high. And his thing, he went to a very good art college, but he was saying that really it's not the art college or the qualification, it's the education that counts. Yeah. Because I think he in that article he did a sum for how much it cost, and it actually cost more to go to art college in America than it did to become a lawyer. I think it was $245,000.
Yeah.
I don't know what it costs here, but do you think it's, in terms of making a living, if you're, as I say, if you're that young person, do you think...
Well, Yeah, I've no idea how people do it in the American system. I know some people who've, you know, mortgaged their lives basically to go to some fancy art college in New York or something like
I
that.
mean,
And
even the
I'm not sure
Italias
if
are
it's sufficient.
expensive. Like the ones in Florence are not they're not cheap.
No, well, I only lasted, my money only lasted for 4 or 5 months, and I got a scholarship from the Green Shields Foundation, so I was lucky that I did that as well as getting some
Green Shield
help.
stamps. I haven't heard that in a while.
Yeah, it was
Yeah, my mother used
Green
to collect
Shields
them.
stamps.
Yeah,
Yes,
I remember getting them at the
Elizabeth G.
cash.
Green Shields. Yeah, Mr. Green Shields, he loved his mother, and he set up this foundation called the Elizabeth G. Green Shields Memorial Foundation, and it was intended to support traditional and figurative artists, and I did. I got a grant from them that really helped with my education,
Oh,
but
that's brilliant.
it's very hard. You know, I think people do. Practicing artists do see the gaps that exist in art education and are trying to fill them in various ways. Like in Dublin, there's the RHA drawing school, which is trying to set up, you know, basically, you know, a facility where people can go and draw on a regular basis, draw the model and stuff like that,
Yeah.
and
And the drawing
build up
studio
just
in
some of
Boswell
those
Street, you know that one?
basic skills. Yes, and you know, working alongside professionals. And I see the appetite for it as well, just through things like Facebook, you know, where, you
Yeah.
know, I'm posting photographs of works in progress or stop motion, you know, time lapse
Yeah.
photographs of my paintings in progress. And the feedback that I get from those shows there's a huge appetite for people trying to work out how the hell do you paint a picture,
Yeah.
and how is it constructed. And like I thought it'd be an interesting idea to, you know, to get maybe young students and work alongside me, you know, in my studio at some point. You know, I may try and offer that, but it's something that, you know, most teaching of art these days is really catering towards the amateur market. And that's true even of the ateliers in Florence. You know, they're mostly funded by amateurs, or wealthy wannabe painters who are probably never going to make it, rather than the really talented students that, you know, a professional painter would say, you know, hey, you know, just come in and watch what I'm doing. Some people, you know, you see Odd Nerdrum, who's a you know, obviously a figurehead for a certain type of painting, and he just attracts talent, and a lot of very talented students have just gone to him, and he just treats them as his guests basically, and they watch what he does, or you know, paint whatever they like. And I like that idea of
Well,
trying
that's a kind
to
of that's a
go
that's
around.
again an older kind of model, isn't it? That's the way it used to be.
Yeah.
You would kind of watch over the shoulder for a good while.
Yeah, it's interesting in that, you know, the whole concentration on individualism in contemporary art doesn't sit very well with that, particularly with Odd Nerdrum, because he's so charismatic and he has such a strong personal style that a lot of his students fall almost completely under the spell of his personality and his technique. And are, you know, try they try to be him,
Yeah.
you know, they try to emulate his technique and be him, and get a lot of criticism for doing that. But the if you look at the history of painting, you know, if you look at the relationship between, let's say, you know, Titian and Giorgione and Bellini, you know, like. Experts still argue over whether a particular painting is by Giorgione or Bellini or Titian, you
Yeah.
know, and they were different generations, but you can see, you know, that the complete awe of the older artist and the attempt basically to just to become that older artist. They just want to absorb everything that that person knows and embody it and do it even better than they can do it. And that notion of emulation, which is a very old and very uncontemporary in the sense that all modern artists want to establish their individual identity as early as possibly they can by doing something completely different and unique and original. That sort of will to submerge the personality in a sort of, you know, almost like a corporate style. It's interesting to see where it will lead. I think some of these younger painters, although they look like, you know, chips off the block, they may end up going interesting places eventually.
Yeah. Once it's absorbed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, going to the complete other end of the spectrum now, how was the Sky Portrait Artist of the Year experience for you?
I enjoyed it. Painters like me who work from life regularly, and, you know, I join a group on Thursdays to draw the model from life pretty regularly, and I'm used to working in a sort of a semi-public setting, working alongside people where you have to let everything hang out, you know, and you have to, you know, you've got a certain length of time where you have to get the work done. And those sort of pressures, I'm sort of used to those. So it wasn't a great shock to me to step into that sort of context. And, you know, I've got a lot of studio time under my belt where I just, you know, lash the paint on. And most of my practice is working directly from life, working from what's in front of me. So I zoned out as much as I could from the sort of the circus. It's sort of like the Sky Arts thing was a bit like painting in the middle of a three-ring circus.
Literally.
Yeah. You know, you've got cameras all over the place and a crowd behind you and the, you know, people keep interrupting you to ask you questions and interview you and how's it going and all of this sort of thing. Mm. But I have to say, I enjoyed the process. I didn't go in. I was really busy at the time. So I went in with a pretty good attitude, which was that I wanted to perform well, but I also did not want to win.
Oh, really?
I did not want to go through because it would have basically fucked up my whole summer, you know, because I would have had to devote the summer to doing lots of basically unpaid work for Sky. And I had, you know, an exhibition planned and all sorts of other stuff that I really needed to get on with to earn a living. So,
but you must like the idea of it, because I mean, it's a little bit like the X Factor of painting, with the judges and the whole. I mean, they have to make telly, so it has to be dramatic and interesting and all that. But
what I do, I think what my sort of painting offers today is, you know, there's photorealism. I don't really work from photographs, and when you're working very directly from life, like that to me always has an authenticity to it, and the struggle is also part of the process, you know. My idea of painting is always, to some extent, it always involves some notion of Jacob wrestling with the angel. You know, there's always a struggle. You never win completely, but the process is a record of that struggle, and the whole thing becomes a sort of a performance, the end result. What you're looking at is the end result of a performance. So I think it's interesting to open that process up using media, using television and things like that. And I think that people are interested in that. I guess, you know, there are big portrait competitions like, you know, the BP portrait competition and things like that. And a lot of those competitions are won by photorealists, and often by people who set themselves, like, you know, I'm going to win the BP portrait competition. Yeah, yeah. And they set themselves 6 months or something like that to do this, you know, amazing, you know, wow portrait, you know, super realistic, super ambitious, all of these things. But they, a lot of them wouldn't open their procedure up to the public, because a lot of it is basically, you know, tracing and copying photographs.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's meticulous, it's time consuming. There's a huge craft involved, but it's pretty mechanical in many respects. And the skills that I have and that other painters have developed working from life, we don't necessarily do well in the BP portrait competition context. But when, you know, when people can see the process that's involved in what we do, it distinguishes itself, you know, it sets itself apart from that. And people also see, you know, when there's one person that four or five different artists are drawing and they all come up with something so completely different, and they're all faced with, you know, a completely different struggle, and what they're trying to capture is so different. That really shows people, I think, the potential, you know, it's personality versus nature, and, you know, trying to capture another personality. All of those things, I think, really, really interest people. And I think what I find interesting in the whole process of portraiture is that sort of engagement person to person. It's to me, it's authentic, you know.
Yeah.
It captures something at the, you know, at a particular moment, a particular time, to consciousnesses, excuse me, connecting together in some way. And even if it doesn't all go well, you know, even if the result is, you know, in some sense still a bad portrait, it still has an authenticity as an attempt and a direct engagement with the other, you know, with what's out there. So that's there's a drama to that. And I think it's worth exploiting.
Yeah. Was it, did you find it good in terms of exposure for yourself? Did you get a lot more work out of it, or did it make any difference?
I'm not aware of a huge difference. I did get stopped in a supermarket by someone who said, "Were you on TV last night?" but apart from that, I'm not aware. I don't think it's made me any money or anything like that. I don't think I've got any extra business through it. But it all helps to raise profile, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It doesn't do any harm to be on TV. And I think it's, you know, in my missionary zeal for showing that, you know, there's still life left in painting and you can still do interesting things with it, I think it's worth doing anyway, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that whole show exposes that, you know, because you see all these different people who go about the same thing in such a different way.
Yeah, but it's there's a lot of talented people out there, you know. There's an awful lot going on in the world of painting that we'd hardly know about, and you certainly wouldn't know about by following the contemporary art magazines or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's an amazingly thriving scene when it gets the spotlight on it. You know, there's an awful lot happening there.
Now, you come across as a very sane, well balanced family man. You don't come across as the kind of crazy art. you know, the kind of cliche of the, you know, I suppose Van Gogh, poor man, is the kind of, it's just whatever he thinks of straight away. Is that a conscious thing? Like, do you take care of your physical health and your mental health, or is that just the way you are?
I try to be who I am. I've never tried to play the genius or the, you know, the stereotypical genius.
No, what I mean is, like, do you look after your health? Is health a thing for you, like physical health and mental health?
Yeah, I try to look after myself, but I'm not all that healthy, you know. I try and get a walk every day, and you know, I'm not a sporty person. I've never been a sporty person, so I try to keep a basic level of fitness. Before I had kids, I used to do a lot more. I loved hiking and hill walking, and I used to get out in the mountains every weekend. But now I have.
Well, you're pretty much married to Bear Grylls, by the sounds of it. You know Bear Grylls?
No.
Your wife is. You don't know who Bear Grylls is?
No.
Oh, okay. Bear Grylls is this kind of survivalist guy on telly. They sort of drop him into this place, and he sort of has to find his way out. And he's just incredible, the stuff he's managed. He's able to do. So when I was sort of, you know, doing my research, I suppose, before we had this chat, I discovered that your wife's a mountaineering instructor. Is that right?
Yes, she's training officer for Mountaineering Ireland, and yeah, so. She's an outdoor girl. we met in the mountains, but now the division of labor means that she gets out into the mountains to work. And while she's working, I'm looking after the kids. I get them out into the mountains too. I think they don't have much choice. They're going to end up with outdoor skills and all the rest eventually. But they're young enough that I'm still a little bit limited in terms of my crack commando training for them. So I hope that they'll all become avid mountaineers and hikers at some point. But
yeah, they look like lovely kids. It's very lovely looking at your Facebook stuff and other stuff you have on Facebook, the way you include your kids and your openings, and they're there. And, you know, I was looking at your something on Facebook, and there's this, you know, strong kind of image of you standing in your studio. And then in the background, I think one of your kids, I think it's one of your sons, is coming through the door in a very kind of familial way. It's just lovely.
Yeah, my other son was taking the photograph for me. Oh, right. I think. Yeah. So, they're deployed for work purposes, and they model occasionally. But they have a healthy contempt for culture. They have no patience for exhibition openings or being dragged around galleries or anything like that. And I think that's very healthy. You know, I think my main sort of educational program has been, I suppose, a little bit modeled on the, you know, on Rousseau, you know, on the notion of Emile, you know, that nature is actually much more important than culture. And the first thing I wanted my children to really appreciate was nature, you know. So I don't take them to museums. I don't care if they have good taste or bad taste or what they like on the cultural front at all, really. But I think it's really important that they appreciate the beauty of our planet and that they get experience in the outdoors. And, you know, we didn't have a television for the first 10 years with the kids, so they didn't get an awful lot of popular culture.
Well, but that's probably why you don't know who Bear Grylls is.
Yeah, that's probably it. But we made the decision that they could watch DVDs and stuff like that, and there was endless amounts of, you know, nature, David Attenborough, and all of that sort of thing that they have access to. But we wouldn't give them much of the sugary stuff and the cartoons and the Walt Disney. So they know pretty much everything there is to know about natural history. And very little to know about so far about human history, but right. They'll come to that later. You know, I think it's the right order to do things.
Do you think your work changed after you had kids?
Yes, well, it certainly it expanded my range of material, you know, particularly as a still life painter, because I found the toys very useful as still life objects and things like that. So I steal a lot of my kids' toys for my paintings, and there's a certain level of collaboration now that they think, oh, you know, that when they go into the toy shop, they come back thinking, Daddy'd love this. So all their dinosaurs and building blocks and trains and things like that have ended up in my pictures. I also, I you know, it's nice. It's nice sometimes when my kids think that a painting I've done is cool, you know, and it's interesting to find what they like and what they dislike, you know. Like I put one of my still lives, I put a Dali watch into, and it so annoyed the hell out of them, you know. They really, why did you do that to the watch? Why is it drooping over the edge of the table? That really annoyed them. But they loved, you know, I did a big painting of a Tyrannosaurus Rex skull, life size, and that was really cool. You know, and even there was a painting I did of sort of a self-portrait with my son, but I painted myself as a centaur, a winged centaur with
I
my
was going
son
to
on my
ask you about
back.
that. That's the one you submitted to the Sky Arts
Yeah,
thing, wasn't it?
yeah, yeah. But the surprise was, you know, when we moved house a couple of years ago, and I was trying to get the paintings up on the walls and find space for them, and I asked my eldest son, would he mind if that painting went in his bedroom? And I was expecting the usual, oh, Dad. And he said, oh, yeah, cool. So that was a surprise, actually. I didn't expect that. But it's nice, you know, because that picture, you know, I'd get a certain amount of flack from my painter friends about painting pictures like that, like, you know, who do I think I am, sort of thing, you know. Am I completely nuts? So
Well, that's what I was going not I wasn't going to ask you, are you completely nuts? But some of your pictures have a kind of mythic quality to them, certainly as I look at them. Does that like stem from your own spirituality? Because I heard you being described as a, what was it, a gung-ho pagan in some interview you did. Is that kind of mythic quality an expression of your own spirituality in some way?
I don't know. I don't think of myself as a spiritual person. Myth is one of those territories, I suppose, that I feel I have a right to. You know, I've a right to go there. I have a right to try things out and make things work. And in my own, you know, where I appear in a painting, I think of myself in some ways as an actor. You know, I'm a vehicle to explore an idea rather than adopting a very sort of expressive philosophy. It's not really about me. It's exploring, it's trying to explore an idea. In that case, it was trying to, you know, grab a territory basically, which is the imagination, you know, to be allowed to paint things that aren't there in a, you know, a very literal sense. To be allowed to do things that are metaphorical and a little bit crazy, because of the types of truth that you can communicate through that. So, it's trying to, I try to be pretty down to earth about what I do, even where I'm doing that. And there's, you know, there's a certain amount of observation involved in, you know, even that sort of painting, and there's trial and error. But there's a will to construct things and also to access, I suppose, you know, I've a pretty broad education. I studied art history. I've had an interest in the history of religion and mythology and things like that, although I've never been convinced by any particular religious faith or orthodoxy or anything like that. But I feel that there's material there that isn't really exploited today, that's almost considered forbidden in contemporary art. You know, there are a lot of realist painters, for example, who I think are really inhibited. They're really afraid to show people their dreams.
Right.
Because if they showed people their dreams, people would go, "Ick," you know?
Yeah.
They're embarrassed by their own fantasies. And there's still this notion today, you know, of what fantasy art is. You know, the whole notion of fantasy art, looking at it from the point of view of you know, high-end contemporary art, it's a derogatory term. You know, fantasy art is for teenage boys, basically. It's all about sex and power and violence and, you know, the gratification of urges.
Yeah.
And I think painters need to do or should do a little bit more to redevelop, you know, fantasy art and working from imagination, and to be, you know, prepared to be, you know, embarrassed and maybe humiliated by what they might show in their work. No, there's a saying by Escher, I think I came across it. Nobody who is afraid of being embarrassed will ever be a genius. And I think it's important that there's, you know, maybe something at stake personally.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of contemporary realist painting that hides behind a sort of objectivism.
Yeah.
And that basically the imagination is shut down. You know, if you look at a painter like Lucian Freud, you know, like he's an amazing painter, but at an imaginative level, he's desiccated. He's utterly dry. It's all optical, and where he does, you know, where he does something that's even slightly, you know, imaginary, it just doesn't work. You know, it's his work only works in terms of objective analysis. It's all about objectification of the subject,
right?
And you know, identification with the subject, and the whole realm that, you know, we're not simply surfaces. We're, you know, there's a life that goes on inside and underneath. And, you know, we need to access that just to be.
Is that one of the truths you were talking about? Because when you're talking about the centaur picture, you were saying it in some way can express certain truths. Is that the kind of truth you were talking about?
Yes. Yeah. It's trying to capture the whole person. Or trying to produce an art that is worthy of a whole person, and that captures, you know, the complexity of human existence, which is not, you know, we don't really live in the real world, you know, like most of us, you know, there's the old, you know, T.S. Eliot said, I think, you know, that, you know, the people have a limited appetite for reality, and I think that's very, very true. You know, our engagement with reality is really very tangential for the most part, and you see that through the media and the news and all of these sort of things. It's so treated, you know. It's so manipulated in terms of the truths that we are allowed to discuss publicly.
So do you know the famous Brian Eno quote about art, you know, this thing about stop thinking about art as objects and start thinking about it as triggers for experiences. Do you think that's right, that sentiment?
I don't know. I'd have to think about that.
Do you know the quote I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
Yeah, it's stop thinking about artworks as objects and start thinking about them as triggers for experiences.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's... Whenever I come across a sentence with art in it, where the subject is art, I tend to think, well, there's probably going to be a gross generalization here, and I can probably object to it as somewhere along the line. And you know, as I said, I don't really believe in art. Yeah, I don't really believe in you know the whole idea of whether art is an object or not.
Yeah, and no, I think what brought it to mind was just the way you were describing about getting caught on the surface of things instead of conveying something that's a bit deeper. And even when you were talking about the actual process of portrait painting, it was like there's something magical that happens between the sitter and the person who's doing the painting, and that if you can capture that intangible thing, and that's what separates it.
Yeah.
That's what brought it to mind.
Yeah.
Okay. So last question, because I'm conscious of your time, and going to put you on the spot a little bit. If there was one thing that you had to pass on to future generations, what would it be?
I suppose my paintings, you know, or some of them, a few of them. I don't have a it wouldn't be a few words anyway or anything like that.
It's all in your paintings, basically, is what you're saying.
Yes, you know, like it's what I do. You know, paintings don't even last forever. You know, I think of myself very much as a painter for, you know, immediate consumption. You know, I'm not looking for the judgment of posterity. I want people to enjoy my pictures now.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if they last, you know, none of my paintings will be around in 20,000 years.
Right.
You know, unless they're buried in you know, underground, like the you know, Lascaux, or you know, one of those caves, because basically, like, human beings are sort of toxic. You know, they're poisonous. They destroy pretty much everything that they get their hands on. So, you know, anything that is in people's hands will have a relatively short shelf life, but you enjoy it while it's there, you know. So I think of my work as with any luck, a feast for immediate consumption. I'm a bit of a doomer, you know. I think the end of the world is around the corner, so I try to enjoy life and produce pictures that people will enjoy. But I think of them more as consumer goods than as investments. You know, it's to be put on the wall and enjoyed by people, and, you know, pretty colors, nice shapes, and maybe a few twists under the surface that will give pause for thought.
Right. At the beginning, you said you don't call yourself an artist; you call yourself a painter. If you introduce yourself to people and you say you're a painter, do they expect you to like paint the bathroom, the whole stairs, and the landing?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes say, "Oh, do you paint houses?" But you know, that to me is closer to what I do. Yeah. You know, if I had to paint a wall, I'd be quite good at it, because I've done a lot of that sort of thing. But it's closer to what I do than the Marcel Duchamp idea of an artist. You know,
right,
I don't really connect with that end of things. So yeah, I'm quite happy to be regarded as you know, as a craftsman, if people take me that way. I'm not offended.
Well, in my opinion, you are, you know, high craftsman, because the level of finish on your work is fantastic. It's just I find it very inspiring. It's really good, and I'm really glad that you do what you do.
Well, that's good. I'm just a messer, though. You know, I just I mess around. You know, I'm amazed that I actually do that. You know, earn a living from what I do, and that it's you know, people.
It's all worked out so far.
yeah. But it's a fun. You know, I enjoy what I do, and it's a great privilege to. Be allowed to do what I do for a living, you know, because it's, and I'm just, I feel so much the time that I'm chancing my arm, you know, it's like, can I get away with this? And, and I do.
Well, keep getting away with it. And how can people find out more about you, Conor?
I have a website, conorwalton.com. You know, if,
and all your social media stuff comes out of that, doesn't it?
If you Google my name, you'll find me. I got some following on Facebook, which I found good for just connecting to people. And you know, I usually post what I'm doing on a
weekly
basis. What I'm doing. Like here I am in the studio, and this is what I'm painting, and. That you know, people seem to enjoy seeing that. So I do that, and I live in Wicklow Town. And if anyone who wants to can come and look me up in Wicklow Town and call in, visit me in the studio.
Very good. Okay, well, I've really enjoyed chatting with you, Conor. Thanks very much for giving me your time.
Thank you for asking me to talk.
All right, great. Thanks for that then, Conor. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti.